Thank you to Mint Mobile and Quince for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
As shared in part one of her story, Jana Gajewski-Lodiger is a mother, educator, social worker, and author from Bastrop, Louisiana. She joins us today to honor her sister, Crystal McCrory Jones, whose life tragically ended February 9th, 2023. Her death was deemed an unattended death, which is when a person passes away without witnesses or medical personnel present, and thus should require certain processes and procedures be completed to properly be investigated. Jana has been on a mission since Crystal's death to compel the local authorities in the small town of Oak Grove to conduct additional investigatory tasks that she believes should have been completed at the start. Jana also now speaks out as an advocate for other family members seeking justice, and sometimes even just a simple investigation, via the media, her books, and in her classroom. The Broken Cycle Media team is deeply honored she's here today to share Crystal with our audience, as well as to share her expertise, advocacy, and warmth. This episode is dedicated in loving memory of Crystal McCrory Jones.
That night that we told my mom was probably the hardest night because I had to go home. And I had to pretend like nothing was wrong because I had an 8-year-old and a 14-year-old. As a mom, I made up my mind that I wanted them to go to school that Friday morning as one last normal day before their entire lives would change. And that next morning, I got them up and I got them ready for school like it was a normal Friday. I didn't let on like anything was wrong. I went to work because I needed some normalcy. I left and I checked them out at around noon that day on February the 10th. And I got them in the car. I took them home. And the whole ride home, they knew something was wrong. They knew that something had happened to someone. And they kept asking me, is it my dad? And I said, your dad's fine. Is it my mama? Your mama's fine. Is it papa? No, your papa's fine. So I got them home. And I finally told them, I said, it's Drake Crystal. And they both looked at me. And they were 8 and 14. The most devastated look on their face that you could possibly have. And they said, is she gone? And I said, yes. I watched them grab each other because that's what sisters do. And I watched them hit the ground and they cried. And I broke down in tears.
The night after she passed away, I made an important text message to my local sheriff. I told him, I know it's outside of your jurisdiction, but I lost my sister in West Carroll Parish. They have ruled it a suicide. I said, I know I might be in denial, but if you can you give them a call over there and just make sure that nothing's left unturned? He immediately texts back. He said, I'm flying in tonight. I'll give them a call. He called over there the next day. And from what he told me, he explained to them that he knew me, knew my family. He knew me growing up and that I was a good kid, that I had done an internship with him, that I knew how the system worked, and that I just wanted to make sure it was a fair investigation and that I just wanted nothing to be left undone. Him doing that, it set me up for failure with the lead investigator, because to this day, I've never spoken with the lead investigator. He actually told my oldest brother, Dane, he said, I'll speak with you. We can have conversations back and forth. But your sister, she overstepped her boundaries, which that to me was the immediate red flag that something is wrong here, because I didn't accuse anyone of anything. I didn't accuse them of not doing their job. I admitted that I might be in denial. I just wanted them to investigate it as a homicide until they can prove it wasn't. No different than what Vernon Gabris, a practical homicide model, says, is to investigate every unattended death as a homicide until you can prove that it's not. And so that's what I thought I was asking for when we went to the funeral home to do her hair and makeup. And when I say we, it was my sister-in-law and I. We were stopped by the funeral home directors, and they said, that's not normal bruising after an autopsy. And they closed the curtain, and they said, if I were you, I would take pictures. And we did. And the most extensive bruising is to her left hand and to her inner thighs. None of that could be postmortem lividity, because you don't bruise after your heart stops. I immediately went to looking for a suicide note in the days that followed. I looked in the mailbox. I told my brothers, I was like, just keep looking in the mailboxes, because my sister wrote notes for everything. So I knew that we were going to have one written somewhere. I said to myself, I was like, I bought Crystal a laptop for her karate studio when they opened it, because she didn't have one. So I texted Tony and I said, hey, that black laptop, can I have it back? I was like, I bought it for Crystal. And this was February, maybe the 16th, 17th. And she passed away February 9th. And he goes, yeah, but I think it's at the karate studio. And I said, what do you mean you think it's at the karate studio? Nobody checked it for a suicide note? He goes, no, nobody checked it for anything. I'll give it to you tomorrow. I was like, well, I'm headed to Oak Grove. I'll meet you and I'll get it today. I was going to make my way to Oak Grove to get it right then before he changed his mind. And he gave it to me. He ended up giving me the password to it. I got in and it wasn't my sister's information that was logged into Google. It was Tony's. I don't think Tony realized that, because if he would have realized that, he wouldn't have given it to me, because inside that laptop was a trove of information. It was his timeline location records for the day that my sister passed away, which didn't match the police report saying that he was at a local high school the entire day. It was Google searches for when is an appropriate time to date after the death of a spouse, just 4 days after my sister's death. It was dating websites. It was financial distress. So it was full of information that I gathered up and I organized. I presented it to the sheriff. These things just don't add up. They might not mean anything by themselves. It might just point to someone being a butthole, but collectively, it just doesn't make sense. And nobody would take the information, look at it, and see what I was seeing. I did a FOIA request for the police report. You have to ask very specifically for what you want. You can't just say, I want the entire case file. You have to say, I want everything that's digital, that's on a body cam. You have to ask specifically what you want. And if it's a closed case, then you're likely to get it. They might redact some things depending on if it's somebody that's related to you or not, especially social security numbers and things like that. My sister's remains open now. Her death certificate has it ruled as suicide, but the case remains open. Originally, it was closed. When it was closed, then I could get everything, and I did. I did them one at a time, first for just the police report. That was all I asked for. Then I did the second one. I used the same template. I just changed the word to crime scene photos, and I got that. And the pictures are pretty hard to look at because it looks like there's a struggle. She has a broken ring finger fingernail on her freshly manicured hand that nobody would listen to us about. She didn't garden. She didn't do manual labor. She kept her fingernails pristine, and nobody questioned that. Somebody took a picture of it in the crime scene photos, but nobody ever questioned it or let us know about it. The basics in Crystal's case weren't done, like gunshot residue testing, fingerprinting, DNA testing, or fingernail clipping. Nothing of that nature was done in her case. There are some scientific things that make us ask more about whether this was done by her. And the trajectory of the bullet is one. When you look at the trajectory from the headboard to where it ejected into the wall, it takes a 90-degree turn. That has never been tested with trajectory and things like that. The finding of the shell casing alone, the fact that it was found 7 days later and it was found supposedly 7 to 8 foot from the bed, it doesn't match where it should have been. I don't want to make this sound gruesome, but there was no blood on the projectile. I mean, there was drywall, of course, but there was no blood on the bullet. That makes you wonder, was it just fired into the drywall? There's no blood spatter on the gun. The gun is clean. It was never tested for any kind of matter. but to my naked eye, I can't see any blood on the gun. I own the gun now. He was given the gun back, which is weird to me. And I was fortunate enough that someone saw him selling the gun at a local convenience store that buys and sells guns legally. They said, I think this is the gun that murdered your sister. So I took a trip and I compared serial numbers. I was just hoping and praying that no one would cause a scene because I have a very unique last name. And I'm very open about my last name because you can Google me. They could sense that I was nervous. I was almost in tears buying it. I knew that they would know that I was Crystal's sister. They ran my license. I was approved for it. I ran the serial number. It was the same gun. And they just asked me, do you want to hold it? And I said, no, I didn't want to touch it. Regardless if it was suicide or homicide, it killed my sister. It did not belong on the streets. They put it in a paper bag and then I left. We've never fired it. It still sits in the same paper bag. So if it could ever be tested for anything from someone that knows ballistics, we have it. Everything that they told me in the police report, that laptop denied it. Google timeline locations, the time of death, it didn't match up to what was on that computer. And that's where things get a little tricky. Because we said, if a time of death is listed, and it's anywhere near 11 a.m., we are going to have a lot of questions. Because that's what time he was passing approximately by the house. When her body was released to the funeral home, so was her death certificate. All five copies were given to her husband, Tony. In Louisiana, as a sibling, you can file for a death certificate online. It's super easy. It costs like $50 and they mail it to you. When I opened it, her time of injury was listed as 11 a.m. The time of death that she was found was listed as 5:05 p.m. There's discrepancies there because the times in the crime scene photos show times before 5:05 p.m. They show 4:55. They show 4:39. And this isn't just digital clocks. These are pictures of her clock on her iPhone, her Apple Watch. They register times before 5:05. So someone was there taking pictures before 5:05 p.m. So obviously she wasn't found at that time. I almost lost my mind. I knew that I had to do something. I texted the sheriff. I asked him if he could call me, and it was on a Sunday. He calls me, and we go over a few of the things that we'd brought to his attention. He tells me that it's irrelevant to the case, and I was like, yes, sir, yes, sir. Wasn't going to argue with him. We get to the point where I said he's speaking to her on the phone around 10:36 for 15 to 20 minutes, and her estimated time of injury is 11 a.m. He loses his mind on me. I don't know what you're trying to pull. Who would have put that on there? I had to go fumble in my car and go get it. Because at this point in time, I was crying tears of joy because I knew I had him talking out of his butt because I knew what this death certificate said. And I went and I finally found it. He still denied it. He says, I'm 1,000% sure that your brother-in-law did not murder your sister, Crystal. I'm not quite sure how you can be that sure of anything when you haven't investigated anything. You don't even know what the death certificate says. We had the conversation before we go to the district attorney. When my brother and I met with the district attorney in March of 2023, we presented to her the fact that the sheriff would not listen to us about anything we presented to him. She immediately backed the sheriff. She said in a recorded meeting that she thinks a thorough job was done. She flat out said, I don't believe that Tony murders your sister. She did not hold back any words. When we asked to see a copy of the police report, she handed us the original police report. I said, can we get another copy of this? And she goes, no, I'm not even sure you're supposed to be seeing this. It was simply a police report. And she goes, why? Is there something wrong? And my brother, he goes, this police report is hot garbage. And he's irate because the police report has Tony in an isolated area the entire day in the small town of Oak Grove, working at a local high school, never leaving that high school the entire day, saying his whereabouts was accounted for. And we knew that's not the information we presented to the sheriff. We presented to the sheriff the timeline of his day, the entire day, where it actually had him in our town of Bastrop, passing by their house. Then eventually he did make his way around 2 o'clock to that high school, but he didn't spend all day there. And his whereabouts weren't accounted for the entire day. We actually mentioned it to the district attorney. The sheriff became so irate with me about a time of death on a death certificate. At first, the district attorney wants to explain away the fact that, well, you didn't get a death certificate because it only goes to certain people. That's irrelevant. We have the death certificate. I have it. I obtained it legally. And then she goes on to say, well, can I explain to you how they get to the time of death? No. I know how a time of death is established, but in Crystal's case, no body temperature was taken. It just says cold, so you can't use body temperature. So how was 11 a.m. established on her death certificate as her time of injury? What medically supports that? If nothing medically supports 11 a.m. as her time of injury, then that means someone saw it, someone heard it, or someone knew directly about it. If that is an error, that's a huge error to be on a death certificate. If that was put on there in an error, then her death certificate needs to be amended from suicide to undetermined, because you don't have enough evidence to have suicide or homicide on it. I don't know is an answer to me. If you don't know something and you want to say I don't know, it's better than a lie. And right now, suicide to me is a lie, because you don't have evidence to back it up. And saying undetermined means I don't know, and that's okay. That was March, April that we had these discussions. After we got nowhere with the sheriff, we got nowhere with the district attorney. We did hire our own attorneys with the Firefighter Initiative out of Atlanta, Georgia, and New Orleans. They did a little work for us. They really didn't get anything we didn't already have obtained other than the 7-minute long recording of Tony's interview with lead detective, which was crucial to me to have that because I wanted to listen to it. The 7-minute long interview, it was done 45 minutes after her body was brought out of the house. And it starts off like this. I'm here with Tony due to the self-inflicted gunshot wound of his wife, Crystal McCrory Jones. That's how he starts off. So right then he rules it self-inflicted, an hour and 40 minutes after her body was discovered. And they treated Tony like he was just their best friend. They asked him what he did that day. They asked him how many guns he owned, and he told them all the handguns he owned, and then that was it. Then they forgot to turn off the recorder, because at the very, very end, he goes, she battled depression her entire life. That's the only thing her mama ever gave her. May of 2023, we hired private investigators. They took statements from some of my sister's friends, her coworkers. They got statements from some family members, and then we ended up hiring a private investigator out of Dallas, Texas. Her name is Lindsay Smith. She wrote a Pursuit magazine article called Unsuiciding Suicide Deaths. She doesn't go around proving that all suicides are homicides, but if it doesn't seem like a suicide, she will fight for it to prove otherwise. She was very open with me in the beginning and saying, but for some reason, I think that your sister's case is a suicide, then I will let you know up front. She told me from the beginning, she's like, I don't think that this is what they're saying it is. And she's been our private investigator ever since. She stuck around with us as we went to Washington, D.C. and advocated with a consultant. We went to Washington, D.C. with the families of Christian Andriacchio, Jonathan Cruz, Lauren Agee, fighting for the exact same cause, injustices in the justice system. The rulings of their loved ones' cases were ruled too soon, with a lack of evidence and a lack of proof of why you're ruling it this way. I was the first one to speak for the state of Louisiana. The other states represented were Texas, Tennessee, and Mississippi. We met with my representatives first, and I felt like he listened to a certain extent, but nothing was ever done from it. I actually got more out of meeting the families of other victims than I did out of meeting anybody in Washington, D.C. I didn't think anybody understood my drive. Nobody understood why I won't let it go. And then I met Ray Andriacchio. Ray Andriacchio is the mother of Christian Andriacchio, who was murdered in 2014. His death was ruled a suicide in 40 minutes. If you ever get a chance, Google his name or listen to Culpable Podcast. They did an amazing series on Christian Andriacchio. And Ray, to know that she had been fighting for her son for 10, 11 years, every penny that she earned was used to fight for her son, for answers, while still living life as a grandmother and a mother and a wife. She gave me hope that I could still live a normal life and I could still fight for my sister. When I lost Crystal, I quit teaching because I said, how in the world am I going to change the world one child at a time? That's not making a big difference.
that's not enough for me. I want to change policies and laws and procedures. So I stopped teaching. I withdrew my retirement, and my husband, with his support and his encouragement, I went back to Tulane University in New Orleans, and I got my master's degree in social work and disaster resiliency and relief and resiliency. And then I was asked to teach this small little kindergarten class in a small little tiny town right next door to the parish I live in. I've never taught kindergarten. They were desperate for teachers. And I finally said, with enough support, I'll do it. And that's where I currently am now. And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. All of my kindergartners know about my sister. She's a huge part of our kindergarten classroom. Of course, I don't go into detail about anything that happened, but her spirit lives with them. I realized maybe changing one child at a time and pouring the love that Crystal poured into me and pouring that into children, it does change the world. And maybe you do have to start with babies. When I lost her, I adopted a dog from the shelter. He had been at the shelter the longest. He'd been there for 2 years, and he was a pit bull mix. And I was like, I want that dog. Like, nobody wants a basic brown pit bull mix dog that has been at the shelter his whole life. So I went and got him. I brought him home, and he has been trained to be a service dog now. He actually gets to go to kindergarten with me on scheduled days, and my kids call him a hero. Like, when they're taking tests one-on-one, he goes in with them and does lockdown drills with them for active shooters. He was my dog for me for anxiety initially, and he's become a service dog for 22 other children who just needed a fluffy friend, and I attribute that all to Crystal. After I lost Crystal, I didn't grieve. I was in like a fight mode of I had to keep everything organized, files and folders and Google Drives and things like that. So late at night when I couldn't sleep, I had to step away from that. So I would write down that day what happened, who I talked to and what they said. I did that every night because I went nights without sleeping. I thought I could solve my sister's case overnight. And it took me a really long time to come to the realization that that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in a year. It probably won't happen in 5. I'll be lucky if it happens in 10. I'll be probably even luckier if it happens at all. But I had to stay sane. So I would write and I would write and I would write. Then one day, my husband, who is like number one supporter, he goes, why don't you just turn all of that into a book? And he said, is it about Crystal? And I was like, yeah. He said, does it have people's names in it? And I'm like, yeah. He said, is it your feelings about them or is it facts? I was like, it's facts. And he said, then put it in a book. And so I did. The first book about Crystal's case, Justice Denied, the first 2 years, it explains from start to finish her story. And I don't monetize off of her books that sell them on Amazon. And I think Amazon sends me like a dollar or something like every time a book's sold. Usually when I do the celebration of life, I did buy a bunch of them and I gave them away to family members because I can get them for cheaper costs. I just do it to spread awareness of her story. I wrote the second book, Justice Denied 2, The Story Continues. And it was a little bit different format because I was playing with it because I enjoyed it. There's a book out called Wholeheartedly. It's a very, very easy read. It's very simple. And it was just about that day. I ended up writing a book called What Love Left Behind. And What Love Left Behind is a story about my 8-year-old little girl. So I used writing just now to relax. I think there will be a Justice Denied 3 book because I still write about Crystal's case almost every night, if not every night, depending on what's going on. I don't know a good stopping point, and it's not at a stopping point yet because I want some sort of justice before I stop this book. And then we'll put an end to the series of Justice Denied. So speaking out about Crystal's story has definitely been healing. What I've learned most throughout this entire experience, and what I'm sure I'll learn even more about the rest of my life, is that this isn't just about one case. It's not just about Crystal. It's about a larger issue within the system. There are huge gaps when it comes to oversight, transparency, and accountability, and death investigations themselves. And those gaps, they don't just exist on paper. They exist in real families. They impact real families, real lives, and real grief. What shocked me the most wasn't exactly the loss of my sister, but it was how everything seemed to move so quickly afterward. Almost like decisions were made before the full picture was truly examined. The way the lead detective ruled it self-inflicted gunshot wound before a police report was even written, before any kind of test could be done, essentially before her body even left the house to go into the coroner's van. It felt like conclusions were reached without the depth of an investigation that a situation like this deserves. And that's a very hard place to exist as a family, because you're already grieving, and then on top of that, you're questioning whether everything that should have been done actually was. So the very systems that we're raised to trust and take their word for it, you're questioning it. And that's where my grief began to shift into something else, more into responsibility. Because when you love someone, you don't just mourn them, but you want to protect them, even in their death. You protect their name, you protect their story and their truth, because even in death, you still want their truth to be told. And that's the biggest thing, is we don't know what her truth is, because the lack of evidence that was collected, that we may never know what her truth is. If you have a death ruled as a suicide on a legal state-issued death certificate, but the case remains open, how is that possible? If a case is open, and this goes for cold cases that have been open for 40 years, if you do a public records request and the case remains open, you're likely not to get anything, which is heartbreaking, because sometimes it just takes an extra set of eyes to look at an old document and say, hey, I see something here that maybe somebody else didn't see, and it could break open the case. The petition that we have is to reopen the investigation and have a fresh set of eyes look into Crystal's case. So while her investigation is reopened, we are still pushing that petition out, because we want a second set of eyes looking at her case, not the West Carroll Parish Sheriff's Office. The next step would be Louisiana State Police, and they've already denied it twice. We have our own careers, our own lives. We shouldn't have to stop what we're doing in our lives to become investigators or our own lawyers or anything like that. We need systems that are built to protect the truth, not just protect cases. We need independent review when conflicts of interest are present, clear and forced standards for transparency so families aren't left in the dark. We need accountability when procedures are not followed thoroughly or when questions are left unanswered. No matter how small those questions might be to the detectives, they might be huge to the families. Because no family should ever have to sit and wonder if everything that could have been done actually was. Grief is already overwhelming. It changes you, it reshapes your entire world, but grief combined with uncertainty, with unanswered questions, that's something entirely different. That's something that stays with you in a way that's super hard to explain, because it's not just loss, it's not knowing, and that's what has to change. We shouldn't be left not knowing what happened to our loved ones. I guess if there's one thing I would say to someone going through something similar, it would be, if something doesn't sit right in your spirit, don't ignore it. That feeling does matter. Ask the questions, even when people make you feel like you shouldn't ask any questions. Document every single thing, even when it feels overwhelming. Seek independent opinions, even when it's difficult to find them, even when it feels impossible to find them. And advocate, even when you're tired, even when you feel like no one's listening, even when it feels like you're not getting anywhere, because sometimes your voice is the only thing that's pushing the truth forward. Even in the moments when it feels like it's not making a difference, it is. Persistence matters, your voice matters, and your loved ones matter. And sometimes your voice is the only voice that is being heard, but you don't know who's on the other line listening. And it only takes one person to make a difference in a case.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I reported her missing on September 11th, 2021. 8 days later, on the 19th, she was found by the Grand Teton Search and Rescue. We work with families who never, ever have answers or resolution for their missing loved ones. So we're so grateful that we were able to find Gabby and eventually bring her home. We all have her ashes and we carry her with us. We're so proud of her because she became the world's most well-known advocate for domestic violence.
Thank you again to Mint Mobile and Quince for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget, if you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/WCN. That's mintmobile.com/WCN. And
don't forget to refresh your spring wardrobe with Quince. Just go to quince.com/WCN for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.